Hello, the internet, and welcome to this episode of the Weekly Zeitgeist. These are some of our favorite segments from this week, all edited together into one nonstop infotainment laugh extravaganza. So without further ado, here is the Weekly Zeitgeist. Guys, we got a lot of news to cover. Omarosa back. Reality TV continues to define the zeitgeist, yeah. You guys, whether it's Kim Kardashian saying someone isn't interesting to look at, or, you know, the president being a reality TV star and turning the presidency into a reality show. And now we have, you know, somebody worked for him in the White House who is only known because of her work on a reality show, not success, just being, as Kim Kardashian pointed out, interesting to look at. That is the most important trait you can have. And Omarosa is definitely interesting to look at.
She's back. And she's messy.
Yes.
And she's got a book coming out.
She does.
So we know what the playbook is. Stir up as much shit as possible to get people talking about you. And the book, I don't know, off top, the White House is like, everything in there's a lie. No, there's nothing true. Like, they were very, very clear that everything in there is just basically slanderous or whatever. But, you know, she kicked off her press tour pretty impressively by leaking two recorded conversations she had during her time there. And it was, like, being so messy. She's like, they're like, oh, Omarosa, do you have more recordings? And she just looks and goes, oh, yes, I do. Like, and it's really acting like a villain from, like, I'm back and I'm ready to fuck things up.
I think I remember her original season on The Apprentice, and that was sort of what she did. She was just like, oh, I'm gonna be a villain. Like, right. She just got it immediately.
Yeah.
Like,
but this is with the government now.
Right,
you know, like,
exactly.
You're taking her out of this medium that ultimately doesn't matter.
I don't think her and Trump know they're in the government.
Oh, in their defense, they don't know.
It's a new set that they're working on.
Right.
Oh, we're just on a different set.
Yeah. Where are the cameras?
Yeah.
And this is what happens when you put people like this in actual decision-making capacities that
100%.
Affect other people's lives.
So, yeah, the first one she talks about, you know, she had a recording of when Chief of Staff John Kelly fired her. And it's a pretty long clip that they have or whatever. But the thing that's interesting about this one, aside from him just hearing, he's basically sort of like, does like a, like kind of G's her up, sort of being like, look, let's make this as nice as possible because we don't want to make things difficult for you after
it's
this.
Like, it's like veiled threats.
Yeah, like, okay, all right, I'll be cool. But this apparently happened in the fucking Situation Room. So she recorded a conversation in one of the most sensitive areas of the West Wing where, you know, that's where, like, Obama watched the Bin Laden hit job, basically.
Alleged.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, if they got him.
Right.
But, yeah, like, a lot of shit
Wolf
goes down
Blitzer
the Situation
wanders
room.
In there by accident.
Yeah, but,
like,
yeah,
shit.
It just shows you.
Damn it.
This room where so many important things have happened. You just can wander in there with your phone or whatever, just make a recording. Whatever. So we found out that she got fired and it was whatever. Then the second clip that she dropped, I think it was either yesterday or today, was a phone call with her and Trump where he acts so Z-O-M-G surprised that she was fired. So apparently she was fired and she in the thing, she's like, does the president know about this? And John Kelly's like, look, this isn't a negotiable situation. Like,
right.
And just like, you know, tough geyser. So let's
be
hear
a
the
shame if something happened to your reputation.
Yeah, essentially.
Specifically, he said that.
Yeah.
Her sparkling reputation.
Right, yeah. As an actual reality star villain, reality show villain. This is the recording that she made when she talks with President Trump right after being fired.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that.
God. Yeah.
Damn it. I don't love you leaving at all.
Whoa. God damn it.
God.
I mean, okay, so you can look at that call
How
two
will
ways.
We go on?
Yeah. You can look at that one of two ways. One is that he actually knows nothing about what's going on in his own administration, and General Kelly just calls all the shots, which is likely. It's conceivable.
Right.
The other is that he totally knew, and just because he's not really confrontational and he wants to be able to be the good guy, acting like all surprised about it, like he didn't even know, like, oh, really? The God damn it to me sounds so full of shit. He goes, God damn it.
God damn.
Oh, yeah, you're so upset.
That was one of the worst performances I've ever seen. Like, just
damn it.
As a liar,
oh, yeah.
That was just not good.
And he is, if nothing else, a well-practiced liar.
Oh,
like, 100%. He lets out much better lies than that.
Yeah. I think there are, like, certain lies he's comfortable with or has convinced himself are true, and this just didn't happen to be one of those.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, okay, she's fired. Okay, let me get on the phone with her. And
what's
it
going
just,
on? What am I reading about?
Oh, my God.
God damn it. And then he's as we were laughing, you can hear him say, I don't love you leaving at all. That's such a weird way to describe that.
Yeah, so you'll hire me back again? Okay, Ambrose, I got to get going.
I got to get going. Hold on, my Big Mac's here.
Yeah.
I don't know. Look, this sort of underlines the whole problem with this administration, too, is because now she's out and she's talking all this shit. Trump is on Twitter coming at her intelligence, you know, typical playbook when it comes to people of color who are, have any opinion on the president is to question their intelligence. But, you know, after that, the media, you know, rightfully noticed what has always been obvious. Like, wait, not a lot of people of color that are working at the highest level in that White House administration. So, you know, on the Sunday shows, Kellyanne Conway was out there, and I think she was on, I forget which of the Sunday shows, basically being asked the question, hey, can you name some people of color that work with the president? And it was a little, you know... She didn't have many ideas.
And the Omarosa was the most prominent high-level African-American serving in the West Wing on President Trump's staff. Who now is that person? Who is the most prominent high-level advisor to the president on the West Wing staff right now?
African-American?
Yes.
I would say that, well, first of all, you're totally... not covering the fact that our Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and world-renowned...
I'm asking you about the White House staff. I'm asking about the people the president is with every day.
Well, the president works with Secretary Carson every day. He's trying to break the back of the scourge.
Who there is on the White House staff right now?
And we have Jaron, who's done a fabulous job and very involved with... He's been very involved with Jared Kushner and President Trump on prison reform from the beginning. He's been there from the beginning. He worked with Omarosa and others of us.
Does he have an office in the West Wing, Kelly?
He has an office in the EOP, absolutely. The executive office. To the president, yes.
But not in the West Wing. What does that say to have not a single senior advisor in the West Wing who's African American?
I didn't say that there wasn't, but hold on.
Who is?
There are plenty of people. If you're going by that and not by the actions of the president, which you probably should, then you should look at the fact that we have a number of different minorities. And the fact is that this president is doing well for all Americans.
Yeah, okay. I mean, just look at all the people he appoints to, like, judicial nominations and everything. He has a thing for white guys. I think it's easy to say.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it.
And at first, I thought she was making up Jaron. I was like, oh, hell no. You just made up that fucking name. But it's true, though. There's a man named Jaron Smith who works with Jared Kushner, like, as a executive aide. But who knows in what real capacity that actually is. But, you know, again, it's not surprising. When you look at just, you know, again, if she's saying, look at the actions of the president, well, then I think that would also be clear to
That's
me.
That's worse, don't it?
Yeah.
Look at the actions of our most racist
president.
Also,
did you see him? He had all those bikers at the White House this weekend.
Uh-huh.
And the one dude had a patch that said, I like guns and titties. Just prominently on his fucking vest.
In parentheses, not necessarily in that order.
No, yeah, but it was
but
wild.
In that order.
He's like, he's got his arm around these bikers and the dude, one of the dude's patches. All right. Whatever.
He's like not that his base is all Harley Davidson riders, but didn't he do something like over the weekend where he's like split? He actually started talking trash on Harley Davidson, right? Because they're going to take some of their operations overseas because of EU tariffs, I guess.
Yeah.
And now Harley Davidson riders like, well, fuck, do I like my bike more?
Right.
Yeah.
Fat racist.
It's calling for a boycott.
I mean, like, Trump is only, if at most, going to be president for 8 years total. Those Harleys, though.
Right.
They trademarked that sound.
Yeah.
You know?
If you take care of it and get their oil changed, if you can do that with a motorcycle, then they'll hold up for years.
I wonder how many, I don't know, what other bike would you ride? A fucking Honda?
Yamaha, baby. No,
yeah,
that's too foreign.
Yeah, that's too foreign. Like a Royal Enfield? Too English, too European. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know shit about motorcycles.
Hey, that's all good,
I thought
bro.
You would, Jack. You strike me as a big hog guy.
With the wild handlebars like up here, above your ears.
It's great. It airs you out. It's terrific.
Yeah. Ride one to work every day.
That's actually a bird scooter.
Whatever. Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
Harley bird scooter. It's the same shit.
I don't know about you guys. I was refreshing my phone pretty regularly yesterday, waiting for, you know, all hell to break loose on the Unite the Right 2 rally in Washington, D.C. They decided to have it right across the street from the White House. I don't know how they figured they'd get away with that, with this president of ours, who's, as you can tell, just looking at his behaviors and his actions, if not his hiring practices, he's the least racist person ever. But so, you know, the idea, I think they had permitted for 400 neo-Nazis and skinheads and white nationalists.
Oh, not officially. We're not aligned with them. Although,
right.
When you put the speaker list, too, they were neo-Nazis.
Right. So they were expecting 400, and they drew, was it
40.
24. It was about two dozen.
Yeah,
people.
Maybe a little more.
Two dozen hundred.
Yeah, so it was between two dozen and 40 that they actually had come out to, you know. I think people last year after, you know, they all showed up in their white shirts and no masks, which was really the most surprising part of their decision, their decor. At the Unite the Right rally, the first one, they were just like, this is cool now, right? Everyone,
yeah.
We're
hey,
good.
We're all the right.
And then a bunch of them got fired.
Yeah, what do you mean I can't come in on Monday?
Communities right. As being hateful racists. And now that apparently did, people weren't fond of how that went down.
No,
because
that's
nobody
just
showed up.
Completely tanked. I mean, not that like there was any stock or social cachet with being a white nationalist, but like people were definitely like, yo, I can't be out here like that. Like, I'm not that down with it. I mean, because I think he could only find about 30 people who are that ignorant and shameless to go out and be like, yeah, we're fucking here for the Unite the Right too.
Right.
The counter protesters, however, they came out in the thousands.
Right.
So, you know, it's very clear that I think, you know, one is less meaningful, let's say, less sexy to the general public. But I think Jason Kessler, man, he's had a lot of problems too, because the other thing that this whole failure of the Unite the Right rally shows is there's a lot of fracturing going on in this whole alt-right community where, like, they don't know who to follow, who actually is the leader. Half of them are getting scrubbed off of Twitter and things like that. So it's become very fractured. And Jason Kessler, like, he's burned a lot of bridges in the neo-Nazi community because there are people, like, on Gab, their, like, you know, chat site that they can talk shit on. They were all being like, no, this guy has no manpower. No one follows him anymore. Like, I advise you to not go. It's going to be dangerous. And you know, he's also like, he hasn't been able to fundraise like on any kind of website that like makes it easier to collect funds from people. So he's basically limited to like cash and check donations. So he's has less and less organizing power. And so it was kind of like on Right Wing Watch, our boy Jared Holt was always saying like, this is probably gonna be a flop just from the onset based on how nobody's really like with each other on the same side anymore compared to last year because of all the
fallout. Jason Kessler was the guy who organized the last year's
Charlottesville
rally.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem with your movement being fully obsessed with categorizing people and hating them.
Right.
Like, you're going to have some divisions that open up, and some of those people aren't going to be fully on board with your type of white nationalism.
One of the white nationalists or neo-Nazis was mad because Jason Kessler had like a non-white person working like at a higher level with him.
Right.
And he's like, not to mention that, like, there's not even all white people in his organization.
Right.
Yeah. So
something I didn't realize, Richard Spencer, who likes to focus his brand of white nationalism and white supremacy on claiming that it's like all about European culture and like different people coming from European nations and having something special. I didn't realize that over the past year, he has been banned from like most European countries.
Yeah, he can't
He's
get
like
in
not allowed to go
Amazing.
There.
A lot of those people can't.
Yeah, people are kind of running away from this movement.
That's how fractured it is, by the way, is that so few people want to join the movement that they have to hire minorities
right.
in order to fill these white positions.
Right.
It's like not even white people
black.
Want this job. Yeah.
As the movie Black Klansman shows, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the plot of that?
The other aspect of this is, you know, last year they had a lot of like paramilitary, they had militias like pull up at the Unite the Right thing, like Oath Keepers and stuff like that to, you know, protect them. And you could see like that site was pretty out there when you saw all these dudes in this tactical gear and being like, yeah, we're aligned with this group. But because of that fallout, those militias have even like pulled away from kind of being out there because the optics like aren't really helping them.
Right.
And I was reading this piece, which is kind of interesting. It's like how the militias have kind of lost their way now that Trump is president? Because even with like Bush 2 and Clinton and Obama, they were able to like have this like, it's this like neo-globalist, you know, conspiracy to bleed America dry and blah, blah, blah. And like, so we got to be ready. And like, so when Trump was running, they were all like, yeah, this is our guy. This is our guy. And a lot of analysts were like, if Hillary Clinton wins, I think we need to really be prepared for what the fallout is going to look like with these militias and things like that.
Right.
But then he won, and now they're kind of like have an identity crisis because they're like, wait, our guy is in power. So what do we
– Yeah.
How Who are do we hate?
Yeah. And like, and they were sort of tracking it. Like first it was Antifa because then it was easy to be like, oh, yeah, okay, we're diametrically opposed. And then that kind of fell off. So then it was immigrants, then Muslims. And yeah. Now the new thing is they're just obsessed with the Civil War.
Yeah.
Like, that's the next thing that they've given themselves. Like, well, okay, we got to be ready for this, like, libs versus conservatives race war.
Drudge was trying to popularize the whole anti-Antifa thing yesterday because, like, a lot of the top headlines were like, it's getting ugly out there. And then it would be, like, a video of Antifa, like, pushing a camera away or something like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. And then a lot of places were writing that shit up, like, in the coverage of this, like, of open white supremacy in this country. They're getting mad at, like, Antifa for clashing with, like, other – like, when you saw, like, in Portland a few weeks ago, the police definitely, from what I saw and, like, what the reporting was, they seem to be much more aggressive with, like, the counter-protesters than they were with, like, the white nationalists. And a lot of the coverage is more focused on what they're doing rather than these white nationalists who are out here, you know, spreading all this hatred. So the coverage of it was a little odd to me, too, from some places. Not everybody, but
– yeah. And I mean, I think there's also a sense in which they overplayed their hand a little bit. Like, I mean, there are people who are invigorated by Trump's, you know, election and feeling like, okay, now I can, you know, let my racist inner thoughts and feelings out into the open. And they did that last year and they sort of overplayed their hand. And, you know, a lot of them got fired from their jobs. And,
right.
You know, I think there's also... Like when you watch that Vice documentary last year with that guy who's like,
oh,
yeah, man, we got
Nazi?
All the guns and we got all this. And like, you know, just talking with his chest out like he was about to go whoop some ass and was very, you know, angry and seemed sure of himself. And then the next video we saw of him, he was weeping and being like, I'm so scared. Please don't hurt me about the cops because he got in trouble for being openly violent. I just feel like. When your movement is about violence and a very, very limited worldview, you're not going to have very stable leadership a lot of the time.
Oh, no, yeah.
And there's another guy who was very, I forget where the article was, but it was a guy who wrote for, you know, a mainstream outlet who used this right-wing kind of mainstay as a source. And over the past year, that source disappeared because he actually stabbed his father to death. Like,
And, oh, was that the guy in Oregon?
Yeah.
Right.
Or Washington State,
or Washington, right, in Pacific
yeah.
Northwest, right.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, so a lot of these people who were big personalities and who were, you know, out there pushing this point of view, they don't last long in the public eye for any number of reasons,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, and it just shows you that the rallying, like, the thing that brings them together is literal hatred
right.
and violence.
Right, right.
That's not, most people are pretty chill.
Right.
You know, they're not wired. Like, you know, you'll have people who are very angry and you can get those people. But you look at the counter protesters, they rally around the idea of inclusion and unity and like empathy. That's a much more broader audience for that
right.
than like, hey man, you fucking hate immigrants, man, and you're
right.
gonna fucking beat some people.
Right.
Like, yo, no, like, no,
right.
really, I'm not that. Like, I'd rather just you know shame some racists.
Right. It's harder to get behind that point of view now more than ever because you can't burn all the books. Like in our, you know, there's still the internet, and like eventually, like the internet can be bad if you just get in. To like one small group where everybody's talking crazy, but like eventually you can go out and do your own research, and doesn't look good. There's also Stephen Miller's uncle just published an article where it's almost surprising how basic it was. He was just like, "Hey, so our great grandfather came here because of you know there were anti-Semitic pogroms, and like he was trying to escape like just." Horrible treatment in his home country, and he came through Ellis Island, and then he like worked and paid for his, you know, to pay your great grandfather to like come over, and it's basically chain migration. And he's like, so how are you going to? It's just like
yeah.
this ideology that these groups and that like your Stephen Millers of the world kind of espouse is just like so transparently just like it doesn't hold up under scrutiny that I don't know. It seems like every time they just get put down or, you know, every time someone points out the insanity of their argument, it's like, yeah, that's pretty obvious, turns out.
And that whole letter, it's like, he's just like, I'm ashamed of him. Like,
yeah.
He knows better.
Yeah.
Like, he and like, the thing that was really to that point is, like, he points out that Stephen Miller is well aware of their family's history. Like,
coming from
like a shtetl in what is now Belarus, like, to coming here. And the article is almost like, my man, how the fuck are you even thinking like this, knowing our family's history?
Right.
Like, that, this exact kind of policy that could have gotten, you know, our ancestors killed, and we wouldn't even fucking be here. You wouldn't even be at Santa Monica High School being like, I think the janitors need to speak English.
Right.
Anybody with me? And that's why I'm running for student president, which was like one of his speeches that he made.
Yeah.
Jesus
legendary
Christ.
YouTube clip of him in high school.
Yeah. I mean, the cowardice of like getting over the wall from like a danger and like pulling the ladder up behind you is... Yeah, it's just obvious. It's like, yeah, man, that's not a good look.
And I don't think they ever cared that it would be a good look, you know, or even thought that, like, that's, like, the most infuriating part of all of this. It's like, yeah, he doesn't care. Like, he knows that his family comes from a long line of immigrants. He doesn't care. Like, he pulled the rope back. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, this is just what's going to keep happening.
Right.
And when he gets called, like, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, what you do is illogical. It's like, yeah, obviously it's illogical. None of it is logical. Hate is not logical. It's just all self-serving things. And I don't think this will, like, oh, Stephen Miller's not a great guy. Holy shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Thank you, Uncle Miller.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I think most people who come to America, like, you know, when you ask all these people, I think pretty much everyone has a backstory about, oh, yeah, they came here for a better opportunity at some point. Even if you're one of these daughters of the revolution type people,
right,
like, there are people still coming here because they're like, oh, I'm not feeling this place. I'm coming here. And this will offer me that opportunity. But it's easy to forget that. I think the only person who came to America and just to not escape anything bad was Prince Akeem in coming to America.
Right. Yes.
Because he was just looking for a shorty.
Right.
Thank you, King Shit.
Yeah. Thank you, Prince Akeem. And
King
Semi.
Shit. Yes, fuck you too. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. All right, guys, let's get into the stories of the day. The Manafort defense has rested. They have dropped the mic. They were like, done and done. I think we've made our point.
I think it goes like this. The prosecution rests. Then the judge is like, okay, now what will the defense be presenting in case? We're good. It's kind of how it ended.
Yeah. So there's two weeks of prosecution calling witnesses who testified that Manafort did like all the money crimes, basically, and did them like flamboyantly, like he thought people couldn't see him, like he was invisible. And there were a couple weird like courtroom shenanigans that we don't totally understand just yet. Like there was a recess that was like a full day recess that nobody really knows why it happened.
A lot of behind closed doors meetings with the judge and defense and prosecution.
And then the defense requested that the case be dismissed and the judge was like, no. But like there's a reason the defense thought that they could get away with that. And then apparently that was their whole idea, because then they were like, okay, now present your first witness. And they were like, we rest.
Nah, we're good.
Yeah. You'd present your first witness.
I don't know what's going to happen. If that means like, you know, a lot of the speculation has been some kind of issue with the jury, whether it was a juror overhearing something or speaking to someone, or if there is a, you know, a huge Donald Trump supporter who's just willing to stay locked in their position and have a hung jury.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like if it's a juror who overheard any of the news for the past 2 years, maybe he's anti-Manafort. I don't know. It seems crazy that we have to have a trial where people would be completely impartial, but because of, you know, this touches literally every aspect of our country. Robert, you just did a Manafort episode of your podcast, Behind the Bastards. You did two Manafort episodes. Mm-hmm. So first of all, explain to our listeners what Behind the Bastards is for people who don't listen.
I mean, our tagline is we tell you everything you don't know about the very worst people in all of history.
Yeah.
And Paul Manafort is definitely one of those. What I say in the podcast and what I truly believe is that his work for Donald Trump is probably the least objectionable thing he's ever done.
That's crazy.
His whole career was built on he's the guy who helped invent the modern concept of lobbying.
Yeah,
there were I think a couple of hundred lobbyists in the entire United States when Paul Manafort started his firm, and he is like, you know, in the late 90s you started getting jokes on like The Simpsons about how, you know, all politicians are the same, Democrat and Republican, they're the same person, they support the same ideologies. A lot of that is due to the fact that the lobbying firm that Manafort started with Roger Stone and a guy whose last name was Black would regularly represent both sides of elections, because a big part of their goal was they would help. They were the first company to put lobbying under and like campaign advice and whatnot, campaign management under the same roof. So they would help both sides of an election in a contested district. And then no matter who won, they could then lobby to that person with whatever corporations were backing them.
Right. So they're at least partially responsible for everything bad that people hate about politics right now.
Yeah. Within a decade of the establishment of Paul Manafort's firm, they went from a situation where there were maybe a couple of hundred lobbyists in the entire country to a situation where there were more than 10,000 lobbyists.
Yeah.
They have a lot to do with that.
Cool.
And Paul Manafort quickly stopped working in the U.S. as much and started working for a variety of dictators and terrorists all over the world. And that's who he spent most of his career representing. The name of the lobby that he invented was called the Torturers Lobby.
Right.
Like that. He's that kind of guy.
Yeah. He's now, like, oh, yeah, you did human rights violations? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to rehab your image.
Right.
You're going to put a suit on, mm-hmm. and we'll present you to people in D.C., and they'll think you're a legit person.
Yeah.
Now, your show's also great for, you know, giving us weird personal details, like that Hitler was a fanboy of Westerns and that totally informed his like military decisions, and that Saddam was a romance novelist. Is there like a surprising personal detail about Manafort that you particularly liked?
Yeah. When he started working with Ukraine's wannabe dictator, Viktor Yanukovych, Yanukovych had just lost an election for president. It was Manafort who helped him get elected a few years later. And his advice to Yanukovych was to basically dress and act exactly like Paul Manafort. They got identical suits tailored together. He made Yanukovych start doing his hair the same way Manafort did. Like, that was how he helped this guy into power. It was like, be like me.
Yeah,
dress
right.
exactly like me.
You know what your problem is, Viktor? You don't have my swag.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what'll put you in. It apparently worked.
Yeah.
Right.
For it's a like, while.
It's like twins. DEF CON, the top hacker conference.
Oh, yeah.
Took place over the weekend in Vegas.
Yeah.
And they demonstrated what they're capable of.
Yeah.
In terms of hacking.
There were a few highlights
yeah.
That we'll point out. There was first a group that hacked an Amazon Echo. And they were basically, they strung together like multiple bugs in like a second gen Echo that could basically allow a hacker to stream audio from a microphone remotely. So just kind of listening on you. But a lot of the DEF CON 2 is also meant for hackers to point out these vulnerabilities and then help these companies be like, hey, you need to sort this out.
Right.
So the group who had found this vulnerability, they've already told Amazon about it, so you don't have to full on worry about this and start putting your Echo inside of like a soundproof box or anything like that. It also requires pretty sophisticated access to like your Wi-Fi network, so I think you'll be all right. But it was just interesting enough to know, yeah, the thing that you thought can happen
right.
Without them addressing that. And then last year, the DEF CON conference got a huge press buzz because they did a lot of work with voting machines.
Yeah.
And they showed how you could just hop in that thing and just mess with the vote tallies or whatever. And this year,
well, thank God they must have fixed that.
Yes,
like you
they
said.
Did. So they did. They totally worked that out. But except this year, they just upped the ante. And again, it was no different. They took a lot of the machines that a lot of states use when they're using electronic voting. They were able to upload their own malicious software. They could change vote tallies, and one of them even just pulled like the hot fire. What's that one GIF with the dude just going with his hands on his cheeks like this? Ah! He had that GIF just play on the screen because you can do anything.
Right.
But the real fun part about this one is they also had 40 children between the ages of 6 and 17 attempt to infiltrate replicas of these election board websites for several swing states. And so what they did was just built out like the exact architecture of these websites and just said, have at it, kids, if, you know, like young aspiring hackers, do your worst. And let's just say the kids are all right at hacking.
Right.
Because
and we are fucked.
They were able to, some of these kids were able to exploit vulnerabilities that they were able to tamper with vote tabulations, change the names of candidates. And one 11-year-old reportedly hacked into a mock-up of the Florida Secretary of State's website and changed the voting results within 10 minutes. But election officials were like, hey, I'm not really impressed by that.
I mean, yeah, most elections are done in, what, 4 or 5 minutes?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And they're like, you know, the environment's completely different. Yeah, because a noisy conference hall is much different than the empty gymnasiums being overseen by octogenarians
right.
asking you, when, where do you live? Yeah, so, you know, again, the kids are, if it's that easy for, you know, younger people with just sort of the basic skills to do it, I think maybe we should be looking into this a little bit more rather than, you know, passing the blame and being like, oh, well, we're not really impressed by this.
It's scary because the details of this, like they, in some of the hacks, they change the candidates' names. And, like, the things they changed it to were, like, Bob the Builder and
right.
Richard Nixon's head. So it's, like, a mixture of, like, juvenile sensibilities. And right. But they're, like, so easily able to just fucking, destroy this thing.
I follow a lot of these people on Twitter, a lot of folks who are at DEF CON, a lot of hackers, because I don't understand that at all. So I just try to listen to what the people who do say. And there was a big thread of people who do security for these things and who actually have been part of coding voting machines, like Diebold and stuff, saying, this is the only field of coders you will find this for. None of us think electronic voting is a good idea. None
right.
of the people responsible for securing electronic voting machines think that it's a good idea to vote electronically because
right.
they're just not secure.
Yeah, and you can't really point to hard evidence like a paper receipt or mm-hmm. something, or like, you know, how we have in California, like the inked up mm-hmm. Voting card we get. So, yeah.
Yeah. They also hacked police body cameras, voicemail.
The Internet of Things is horrifically insecure.
The body camera one was wild because they were, you know, hackers were able to like remotely download the footage, edit it, and then re-upload it, and they weren't like, it was untraceable. Like, you wouldn't have known that someone had just switched out a video file in there.
Jesus.
So that's cool. Hey, that's pretty cool.
Hey, man, that's cool.
Hey, so what else they do? Oh, they're able to live stream footage. So they're saying, you know, criminals could just basically tap into a feed and be like, oh, okay, that's where you are? Okay, that's pretty cool.
It's one of those things. It's weird because, like, in the 90s, it's sort of similar to what happened with gaming in the 90s, where there were all these pundits, like, screaming about how dangerous video games were, and it was bullshit. And so now when people try to point to, like, no, there's actually some things we need to be concerned about psychologically of what, like, violent video games do to people— that doesn't get any traction because we were so used to, like,
it being bullshit.
It's the same thing with hackers. We're so used to movies in 1998 where people were hacking cars and stuff. And it was like, that's not possible. But now it is. Now we have autonomous cars.
Straight
and they can be hacked.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Remotely started, remotely stopped.
Yeah.
Whatever
you
need.
So our reflex to reject that as a possibility is out of sync with the reality of the situation.
100%. The voicemail one was really interesting, though, because I never thought of how that works. But so what they were saying is, like, you know, a lot of our mobile carriers, they were just terrible at securing voicemail because we're still using like 4-digit pins. Most people don't even know what their pin is because you can just dial it straight from your phone now.
Right.
And it's usually just the last four. It'll default to being the last 4 digits of your phone number.
Cool.
So, yeah. So then basically what hackers can do, they can just brute force access your shit because there's also no limit of the number of like incorrect passwords you enter where it just locks it down.
Right.
So you can just have at it. And then once they do that, they can get into your voicemail system. They can request like WhatsApp send, like, you know, the target's code via a phone call. And if they don't pick it up and goes to voicemail, then they can access the voicemail, get the code, and then put your shit, like, you know, log into your PayPal, eBay, other shit just by using this like voicemail hack. So that's another cool, pretty cool thing that's going on.
Well, fortunately, we have our top minds at the top of the government just sort of locking everything down.
Yes.
As
artful.
Oh,
but didn't they
just
pull a bunch of funding from that?
Yes.
Yeah.
You guys, Crazy Rich Asians, I think, opened last night and, you know, is opening over the course of this coming weekend. It's getting really solid reviews. I'm excited Constance Wu is the lead. I feel like her performance as the mom on Fresh Off the Boat is, I don't know, it reminds me of like what a lot of Asian Americans I know say they love and respect about their own moms. She's like unapologetic and strong and, I don't know. I read one person talk about the moment in the Crazy Rich Asians trailer where she laughs and she like laughs hard and loud and like doesn't cover her mouth. And they were like, that act is not normal for an Asian character in a, you know, Western movie.
Yeah. So, I'm seeing it tonight.
Yeah. That's dope.
We'll see what happens.
I watched it last night.
How was it?
It was fine.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm thinking too. I think it's more about the representation than the film itself.
Yeah.
But
it was a fine rom-com.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, something about, like, where I am in my media consumption, but I'm just like, oh, this is nice that, like, now we're doing, like, a rom-com with a majority Asian cast or, like, entirely Asian cast.
Yeah.
But it's, like, it still felt, like, weird. I don't know how to explain it. Like, so I went with my brother, my younger brother. I have two younger brothers. So I went with one of them and went with my partner. And my youngest brother was like, man, I've never seen so, like, such white Asian people before in my life. Like, they're all Asian. But, like, because in the film, a lot of them had gone to, like, prep school in the UK, theoretically.
Right.
So they all have English accents besides, like, Constance Wu and her mom character.
Oh, interesting.
So they're all, like, these colonized Asians speaking, like, the Queen's English.
Right.
And, I mean, it was fun and all, but, like, because I had read so many, like, hype tweets beforehand.
Right.
Where Asians were, like, dying over it. They're like, I cried, like, 5 minutes in and I couldn't stop crying. And I was like, really? I mean, like and I'm a crier.
Am I a bad Asian?
Yes, and I'm a super crier, and I just wasn't, like, feeling it on that level. And I don't know if it's because I went in with some other feelings, but I definitely understand, like, representation matters because, like, that's, like, a first step towards, you know, wider acceptance, et cetera,
right.
et cetera, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to say, like, this movie needs to do a lot of work because it's just this one movie, and I think the problem is that, like, there hasn't been movies like this. But in a way, there have been movies like this, right? Like, the Namesake, which is about a South Indian family. Our South Asian family who were Indian. And then there was, like, Better Luck Tomorrow, which is about a bunch of, like, suburban, like, mostly male East Asian kids. But, like, there have been movies where there were, like, majority Asian casts. But there's something about this movie and how, like, it's, like, so capitalist-y.
Right.
And how it's being upheld in this very specific way that, like, kind of fucked that. I don't know. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not vibing with it. And I feel bad.
Yeah, well, no, that's how I was, you know, because I feel like a lot of people from Singapore were definitely vibing because they're like a lot of the cultural touch points were very relevant to people in Singapore. And I think I'm excited that we're looking at a film like this that's got an Asian cast and we're moving that direction. But yeah, I think it has to be a first step to then begin telling, I think, spreading the diversity of stories out a
right.
bit too from here. I think the first one shouldn't be too bad, but we'll see. I'm gonna go see it tonight. I didn't grow up crazy rich, so I hope from that standpoint, it's not too abstract, but I think at the very least, it's nice to see familiar faces on the screen because before that,
I was just like, man, of all the feelings that I'm feeling after watching this, I just feel so fucking poor. That was like my overwhelming feeling. I'm like, I feel so poor and I feel like I don't have a strong jawline, like my face isn't right because like the Asians in this film also look a very specific way.
Right.
Like the men, oh my God, like people are like, women, especially viewers, are like, man, the female gaze in this film is, like, so extraordinary. But I'm like, so what? It's just, like, some packs. Like,
Right.
It's just some six packs, you know?
Yeah,
right.
I get it, but it's also like, well, what is this? Why are we so into things that we criticize when it's, like, white folks? You know what I'm saying? But then, like, when it's, like, just because it's, like, being embodied by Asian folks and we're, like, all for it. I mean, I want this movie to do well. I want it to, like, fuck up the box office. I heard that it's like it's gonna do great and I want it to do well, but I'm just kind of underwhelmed.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
by its nature, the whole accomplishment here is that it is a mainstream movie that is going to get wide release, and inherently mainstream movies have certain things that go along with them, like that every character is good looking and usually like wealthy and yeah, like Better Luck Tomorrow is a really good movie, but, you know, I don't know too many people who saw it. But the director of that has gone on to have, like, a huge, amazing career.
So. Well, you're going
to
love my film that's coming out called Ugly, Broke, Biracial People. it's gonna resonate with people.
All right, guys, let's talk Elon Musk. So a New York Times article came out last night. It was an interview with him where he, you know, just seems like he's at the end of his wits. He is feeling sorry for himself that he didn't get to hang out with his friends on his 47th birthday, which who still celebrates their 47th birthday. But he's like, you know, I just spent it in the in the lab, like, working. I didn't get to see anyone. And then, like, has to stop himself because he's about to break down crying. But
wait,
that's
really, a live interview?
Yeah. It was, well, you don't see it. It's like a
description.
Right. It's a piece of journalism, yes. Like written journalism. But, you know, he just really seems like he's at the end of his wits. His lifestyle, by his account, it's like all about the job. And it's just like he's been working 120-hour weeks. And that might be true. I mean, he definitely presumably works a lot. But it's all like his account is also woven throughout the New York Times talking about the fact that the board at Tesla is investigating whether he's like tweeting in altered states of consciousness. They mentioned the drug Ambien and also the fact that he has been known to use recreational drugs. And so there was a thing that happened like last weekend, I think.
Or the beginning of this week. I don't know. Time is so fast and
he's
slow
been
at
doing
the same
a
time.
Lot over the last few months. Like when he called that guy a pedophile.
Right, he called a guy
a
pedophile. They mentioned that. They mentioned the fact that he tweeted without consulting with his board that he's thinking about taking Tesla private.
And had secured the funds for it, which shifted the market.
Right.
And I think the SEC will probably want to say something about that.
And which he hadn't. So it was like an illegal tweet. But Azealia Banks, she's a rapper, for people who don't know, and she has been working on her second album for a long time, and she's working with Grimes, Elon Musk's girlfriend. And she was tweeting or posting on Instagram that she had been basically holed up in Elon Musk's house for, like, days.
Right.
And she was like, yeah, I'm waiting for Grimes. She invited me out here to L.A. to stay at Elon Musk's place to put the finishing touches on our album, and she just like never showed up. And here's what she tweeted. She wrote that staying at his house was like a real life episode of Get Out. And then she said, lol, I waited around all weekend while Grimes coddled her boyfriend for being too stupid to know not to go on Twitter while on acid. Then she had the nerve to go ghost and book me a first class flight through Roc Nation. So basically sent her out of LA. So that it's an interesting.
This
account.
Wouldn't happen if he had a woman his own age. This is a problem.
Right.
This is you know, a woman his own age. If he had a grown woman, she'd take his phone and be like, "Leave Twitter alone. This isn't for you. We're too old for this."
And right. You're on acid.
And you're on acid, and you need to chill and take a nap. And she put him to bed.
Yeah.
But this is a problem with these older men. They're like, "I don't know what's going on. I've lost grip with reality." You're like, "Yeah, you're 47, and you're with someone half your age, and she's young, and she's just excited." Like. Get a real one and chill.
He had a real one. He had a wife who was, I think, around his age and who he has children with, who wrote an article about how he treated her like a...
You don't say a guy from an African mining family was treating people like property.
He said on multiple occasions that if she were an employee, he would fire her. Throughout the course of their marriage.
So hasn't said that to their partner?
Anyways.
I'm going to call HR, your mother. She'll sort this out. You need to come get your son. He's talking crazy again. Okay, put him on the phone.
His dad.
But young women will put up with that shit. These old guys, they know. They know that there's only so much.
Well, yeah, because if you're not at a certain level of maturity, you're going to sort of match the partner or something. So if it's someone young, rambunctious, and just being like, yeah, let's fry up today.
Yeah, think about what you put up with when you're 20. Like, if I was 20 and a guy was just like, okay, I'd be like, great. And now I'm like, no, you got to be this. You got to do this. You got to have your shit together. Like, your list of demands is more.
Yeah.
Our expectations are higher. And
rightly so. It's good. Then you meet someone else who, and you match each other's expectations. But it's like,
yeah. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're back. Speaking of surprises, guys, The Meg. So
What is The Meg exactly? I mean, I know it's a movie. What is it about?
It's about a
big ass shark.
An extinct species of shark that was like basically a giant great white, except more deadly and like more angry and better at killing. It's called the Megalodon is the full name for it. And if you were obsessed with sharks like I was when I was a kid, it's like, you know, just this mythical creature that's like
in terms
so
of
cool.
Scale, it's like to a great white shark what a great white shark is to a salmon.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's tight. Wait, this already happened. There was like Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
There's right. been a lot of movies.
Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus.
So, I'm trying to like puzzle through this because I pay attention to the box office. They're usually like on Friday, they will put out their box office prediction, like these box office analysts, and they'll usually be between like 5% and 10%. Like sometimes they're just like right on point being able to predict exactly what something's gonna make. The Meg came out this weekend. It doubled what Box Office Mojo was predicting.
Holy shit.
It pulled in $146.9 million globally. Nobody really
saw that. Is
that
more than Solo got?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It destroyed Solo. It might be more than Solo's made.
Fucking Disney.
Yeah. But so I'm trying to figure out like what about this connected so much with people. I'm thinking there's something about... So... There's been shark movies since Jaws. There's Deep Blue Sea. There are shittier shark movies like, Sharknado and stuff like that. But I wonder if there's something to it being a singular, like there's been sharks movies, like where there are multiple sharks, but not a like singular shark movie. And I think there's like something about one giant man-eating shark that makes... I don't know, that appeals to us a little bit more.
I also know, I mean, Jack, you and I have been making content for people on the internet for a very long time, and we've noticed that it's definitely cyclical, what people are interested in.
Yeah.
And when we were both at Cracked, in the early years of Cracked, some of our most successful articles were lists of weird prehistoric animals and monsters and insects that were scary. And then for years, you couldn't get people to read that stuff, and maybe it's just that that shit swung back around and people are interested again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely true. I think people have always been interested in big prehistoric creatures. I think what happened at Cracked was that we created a type of article that we were the only ones doing it, and then BuzzFeed and a bunch of other websites like basically saw that those articles were popular.
Listicle.
And yeah, the listicle.
Listicle.
Well, and they like flooded the internet with articles that were indistinguishable from ours. They weren't quite as good as ours, but they were like easy to confuse with it. And when you're on the internet, you can't tell the difference.
So I can blame y'all for these 15 teen celebs have taken a turn for
the
worse.
No, it's still BuzzFeed's
number
fault.
Number six will make you die.
Shout out a terrible version. But to your point about like the cyclical nature of things, one thing we did notice in their early days, and I think up until the end at Cracked, was that robots were no longer scary to people.
Yeah,
like,
right.
In the 80s, they were like a thing that the whole world was terrified of, and there were all these movie franchises. And
shout out to Batteries Not Included.
Yeah, and then like starting in about 2008, 2009, we just like couldn't get people to read about robots in any way.
Yeah,
unless it was like, this robot's fucking cool and does a thing that's going to solve a problem that you have.
We had at least exactly one article about drones that got decent traffic, and then no one wanted to read about drone war anymore.
Right, like, yeah, that's right.
I wonder if some of it might also be, though, like right now you've got a bunch of it's a very political time in the country, and you've got a lot of very political movies, Black KK Klansmen, or however we're supposed to pronounce it.
Just Klansmen.
Sorry to Bother You. And like a lot of political stuff that's dropped recently, and maybe people were like, oh, it's just a movie about a big-ass shark. That seems like it'll be
turn
a
my
palate
brain off.
Cleanser. I just I don't want to think about the fucking state of the world.
That is what it is. It's so broad.
Yeah.
And
completely
it's basically shark. It distills Shark Week's, the energy of Shark Week, and puts it into a movie that like they also engineered to be accessible to China and America. And I think because
it put up 46 million in America, it put up 50 million in China.
Right.
That rarely happens. Because,
you know, really when you get that on screen duo of Jason Statham and Li Bing Bing. I mean, you know, that's just money in the register, bling, bling. But with these two, I think it's just because it's so, it's just easy to understand. Big ass shark, motherfuckers are scared.
100% of humans can understand
nuanced.
The appeal of that. It's not like Star Wars where there's a lot of cultural things as to whether or not you find that story interesting. It's just, oh yeah, big shark attacking people. I'm scared of sharks.
Right.
I've swam. Like.
Right. And I think, because like the shallows are 47 meters down, those are a little more nuanced for shark films.
And there are multiple sharks. I'm telling you, that has something to do with it.
Well, no, the shallows was just one, right?
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was that lady who goes out swimming and gets the shit bitten out of her. And then, that was a pretty fun, I enjoyed that.
They're intense. But I think with this one, you can just look at a shot where like one shark is the size of like 900 people and you're
Yeah, that shot in the trailer of like there's a bunch of people swimming and you see the shark's mouth in the water and it's as big as all. And you're like, I want to see a shark
all
eat a bunch
of
people. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a Roland Emmerich movie, but with a shark. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, maybe I was overthinking it, and it's just like, yeah, it's a Roland Emmerich movie with a giant shark.
Yeah, well, I guess that's how much we're dumbing things down. Where we're like, surely people's tastes have to be a little more refined than such an aggressively B movie or whatever. But at the end of the day, you just want to see some motherfuckers get eaten by sharks.
Super producer Anna Hosnier is writing a question to me. Team field trip, I think that's a good idea.
Bring a sprig soda.
To go hunt down the megalodon that lives in the Marianas Trench, right?
We
hijack James Cameron's submarine and write it down there with a bunch of shotguns and take out that damn fish.
Hell yeah. Or why don't we just get Meg tattoos?
Either
or.
I thought that's what she meant by team field. Yeah. Go get Meg tattoos.
Yeah, we'll get Meg tattoos. I'm just get a big shark on my throat.
But I mean, the first Jaws is a B movie executed by like a Hitchcockian great director, and the first Jurassic Park, I'd say the same thing. And even though the first Jurassic Park has the raptors, it still has this like the T-Rex is like the singular monster that's like lurking out there that you're constantly aware of. It's not just like a bunch of different animals.
Have you seen what the projections are for this weekend? They think it's going to double.
They think the Meg is going to double?
I can see that because it's a surprise.
Internationally,
and
yeah.
When something is a surprise, people start piling on.
Another thing in one of these articles I'm reading that an analyst did point out was sort of like it comes at the right time where all the traditional tentpole movies in the summer have already happened. People are right about to go to school. So you get your last hurrah in. And it's like nothing too weird. Like you now really have to wrap your head around it. So they kind of found like a good lull.
I think Crazy Rich Asians is going to do well this weekend too.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, I think so.
I hope that next year is 50% movies about sharks and 50% movies with Ken Jeong as a major character.
And it could be that sharks just kind of are a great metaphor for the time we live in now, where like we're innocent people and there are just a few disgusting sharks out there wanting to do the most.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the shark clearly represents Donald Trump. I didn't say it.
I meant Spectrum Cable.
Oh, okay.
They do not. I got words.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's Weekly Zeitgeist. Please like and review the show if you like the show. Means the world to Miles. He needs your validation, folks. I hope you're having a great weekend, and I will talk to you Monday. Bye.